All right, page 48. When I told you before we couldn't get to the woman, I didn't know I had it right here in front of us on page 48. So here we have the scripture. This is that Revelation 17 passage. And there came one of the seven angels that had the seven bowls and spake with me, saying, Come hither, I will show thee the judgment of the great harlot that sitteth upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication. And they that dwell on the earth were made drunken with the wine of her fornication. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting upon a scarlet-colored beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and decked with gold and precious stone and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup. Now there's the emblem that you see there, full of abominations, even the unclean things of her fornication. And upon her forehead a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of the harlots, and of the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints, and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with a great wonder. And the woman whom thou sawest is the great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth. And that present seat is Rome. And notice she's drunken with the blood of saints. 150 million people that she put to death. All right, let's go further. The title of Pontifex Maximus became officially the title of the Pope at the time of Pope Gregory VII, who's better known under the name Hildebrand. He was ruler from 1073 to 1085 A.D. Now, look at this continuing again from this book by the priest. The word Pontifex, from Ponce, Pontus, bridge, and facere, to build, means bridge builder, and was the title of certain Mithraistic priests, that is, this old secret religion. The emperor, as a defender of the faith, had the title of Supreme Pontiff. The pagan pontiff of Rome annually sacrificed to the river gods 24 victims who were thrown from the sacred Sublician bridge into the Tiber. During imperial times, the emperor was the highest Pontifex Maximus. Emperor Constantine, died in 337, held the pagan title of Pontifex Maximus. And when he was converted to Christianity, he made himself supreme pontiff of the Christian church. The Roman church itself, therefore, admits that the words pope and supreme pontiff are both of pagan origin and did not become the official titles of the Bishop of Rome until after the final schism, when Pope Hildebrand assumed universal dictatorship. Now there's a story by a Roman priest, as clear as you can ask for it. Coming down the side a minute, the seventh world power attempted to seize Jerusalem during the Crusades. Now I don't know how many of you studied the Crusades. They're worth your reading. They are the effort by the Roman Catholic Church, the seventh world power, to grab Jerusalem, because the Antichrist wants to take over, Satan wants to take over and set himself up ruler and king of kings in Jerusalem. He wants to take over the temple. He wants to sit himself in God's place, showing himself that he is God. Why do you suppose they go and kiss the feet of the Pope? And all of these people carry on like this, as though he was something holy, when in reality he's the devil's masterpiece for the present period of time. So the first crusade, and tens of thousands of people died in these crusades to try and seize Jerusalem. Watch what it says about it. The first crusade in 1096 A.D., the second crusade in 1144 A.D., the third crusade in 1187 A.D., and we'll come back to that middle part on Western history in just a minute, but let's go down the side. In 1099, the crusaders did capture Jerusalem and held it for a short time. Robinson says in his history, page 193, the crusaders, with their customary barbarity, massacred the inhabitants. Now that's the peaceful, loving Pope. So when he talks about peace and talks about just words, he's the liar that his father was from the beginning. There's no word that he speaks that's truth. And if you're fool enough to believe the Pope, you are a fool, because he is the mastermind, the leader masterminded by Satan. And that's where he gets it. He's the father of liars. He was a murderer from the beginning. And just like the history says, they massacred the inhabitants. That's what they always did. great tribulation fell upon thousands of those in this Thyatira church at the hands of the rulers of Satan's seventh world power. This great tribulation is better known as the Inquisition. But let's look at this history of Western Europe by Robinson. Now, this is nothing but a secular history. I couldn't put all the histories I could find. I could fill books of this. I mean, there have been enormous books written on this thing. This isn't anything that's secret. It's just that it isn't taught in the schools because you're not supposed to be against any religion and because you can't speak out and you can't put a lot of this on radio so the people aren't alerted to what's going on. Among the writings of Gregory the Seventh, this is a book I had in college, an engineering college. I mean, this hasn't got anything to do with Christian schools or anything. My school was certainly nothing near a Christian school. I only had one professor that even had any semblance of being God conscious. The rest were all a bunch of atheists. And here I was in the school and this was their history. So I just tell you that because I don't want you to think it's a colored history. It's not. If there was anything religious in it, they would have thrown it out long ago. All right? Among the writings of Gregory the Seventh, there is a very brief statement called the Dictatus of the powers which he believed the popes to possess. Its chief claims are the following. Listen to this now. The pope enjoys a unique title. He is the only universal bishop and may depose and reinstate other bishops or transfer them from place to place. No council of the church may be regarded as speaking for Christendom without his consent. The Roman Church has never erred, nor will it err, into all eternity. No one may be considered a Catholic Christian who does not agree with the Roman Church. No book is authoritative unless it has received the papal sanction. I'll try to get sanction for this book as quickly as I can. Gregory does not stop with asserting the Pope's complete supremacy over the Church. He goes still further and claims for him the right to restrain the civil government when it seems necessary in the cause of righteousness. He says that the Pope is the only person whose feet are kissed by all princes, that he may depose emperors and absolve subjects from allegiance to an unjust ruler. No one shall dare to condemn one who appeals to the Pope. No one may annul a decree of the Pope, though the Pope may declare null and void the decrees of all other earthly Pope powers, and no one may pass judgment upon his acts. Come on, some more. Robinson's a good historian, and he gives it to you nice and clean. All right? We have already had abundant proofs that the medieval church was very different from the modern churches, whether Catholic or Protestant. In the first place, everyone was required to belong to it, just as we all must belong to the state today. Didn't I tell you it was a seventh world power? They had to belong to it. One was not born into the church, it is true, but he was ordinarily baptized into it before he had any opinion in the matter. All Western Europe formed a single religious association from which it was a crime to revolt. To refuse allegiance to the church or to question its authority or teachings was reputed treason against God and was punishable with death. That's your great Christian leader. The medieval church did not rely for its support, as churches usually must today, upon voluntary contributions of its members. It enjoyed, in addition to the revenue from its vast tracts of land and a great variety of fees, the income from a regular tax, the tithe. Those upon whom this fell were forced to pay it, just as we all must now pay taxes imposed by the government. So you see, the tithe was regarded as a tax, and there where it comes from, and it filters down into some of the churches today that insist on tithing. It doesn't come up from the Bible for the New Testament church. It comes from paganism outside. It's obvious, moreover, that the medieval church was not merely a religious body as churches are today. Of course, it maintained places of worship, conducted devotional exercises, cultivated the spiritual life, but it did far more. It was, in a way, a state. That's what I said. It's the seventh world power. For it had an elaborate system of law and its own courts in which it tried many cases which are now settled in our ordinary tribunals. It had also its prisons to which it might sentence offenders to lifelong detention. And that is true. When you go inside a Vatican City, you are not in Italy. You are not in Rome. You are in the Vatican Empire. And when you go inside the Vatican Empire, the Pope is sole ruler. He has his own army. He has his own post office. He issues his own postage stamps. He has his own banks. And he owns banks in many places of the world. And it was the bank that I showed in the picture in the book Babylon that I put out, where it calls it the Bank of the Holy Spirit. And it's a blasphemous system. I'd have been debating whether to put in the museum a bottle that was brought back to me which contained wine sold by the Catholic Church in Mexico to get drunk on. And that bottle is labeled Sangre de Cristo, Blood of Christ, sold by the Catholic Church to get drunk on. And that's the kind of system that it is. All right? The church not only performed, I'll show it to any of you if you'd care to see it, the church not only performed the functions of a state, it had the organization of a state. Unlike the Protestant ministers of today, all churchmen and religious associations of medieval Europe were under one supreme head who made laws for all and controlled every church officer wherever he might be, whether in Italy or Germany, Spain or Ireland. The whole church had one official language, Latin, in which all communications were dispatched and which its services were everywhere conducted. I thought you ought to have more than just that one history, so I have Claire's Library of Universal History, which is another independent history. Instead of being disheartened by the German king's violence, Pope Gregory VII convened a council of the church at Rome, solemnly excommunicated Henry IV, see, he rules over the kings of the earth, declared him no longer king of Germany, absolved his subjects in Germany and Italy from their allegiance to him, deposed several prelates in Germany, France, and Lombardy, and published a series of papal constitutions in which the claims of the popes to supremacy over all sovereigns were boldly avowed. The most important of these claims, which constitute the basis of the political system of the papacy, were that the pope alone can be called universal, that he alone has a right to depose bishops, that his legates have a right to preside over all bishops assembled in a general council, that the pope can depose absent prelates, that he alone has a right to use imperial ornaments, that princes are bound to kiss his feet and his only, that he has a right to depose emperors, that no synod or council summoned without his commission can be called general, that no book can be called canonical without his authority, that his sentence can be annulled by none, but he may annul the decrees of all, that the Roman Church has been, is, and will continue infallible, that whoever dissents from the Roman Church ceases to be a Catholic Christian, and that subjects may be absolved from their allegiance to wicked princes. Let's go some more. For now we come into this terrible period called the Inquisition. Excuse me. Some of my other courses touch on these too, because this is an absolutely horrible period that isn't taught in the schools. And the boys and girls don't know about this at all. And very seldom that they can tell me anything about it. That most learned, this is on Handbook on the Papacy by William Shaw Kerr, that most learned of English Roman Catholics, Lord Acton, wrote, quote, now this is a Roman Catholic writing again, "The Inquisition is peculiarly the weapon and peculiarly the work of the popes. It stands out from all those things in which they cooperated, followed, or assented as the distinctive feature of papal Rome. It was set up, renewed, and perfected by a long series of acts emanating from the supreme authority in the church. No other institution, no doctrine, no ceremony is so distinctly the individual creation of the papacy except the dispensing power. It is the principal thing with which the papacy is identified and by which it must be judged. The principle of the Inquisition is the pope's sovereign power over life and death. Whosoever disobeys him should be tried and tortured and burnt. If that cannot be done, formalities may be dispensed with, and the culprit may be killed like an outlaw. That is to say, the principle of the Inquisition is murderous, and a man's opinion of the papacy is regulated and determined by his opinion of religious assassination. So you see, your terrorists are in Rome, and they're heavily in Rome. All right, 50. Now continue a little bit further in our text, verse 26. And the one having victory, and the one keeping my works until the finish, I shall give to him authority over the Gentiles. And verse 27, and he will shepherd them in a rod of iron, as the vessels, namely the ones of pottery, are being shattered, as I myself also have taken and still have of my Father. All right, now we go to verse 28, and I shall give to him the star, namely the one belonging to the morning. The one having an ear, let him hear what the Spirit is saying to the assembly. These verses are not only difficult, but their understanding is very dependent on how one understands the symbolism of several words. Finish, he will shepherd them, who, rod of iron, vessels of pottery, star belonging to the morning, and so forth. First, who is the one having victory? Quote, who is the one having victory over the world if not the one trusting that Jesus is the Son of God? 1 John 5:5, we've had it already. But how is this determined? All the assemblies will come to know that I myself am the one searching kidneys and heart. This is the only use of kidney in the New Testament. But this expression comes from the Old Testament. You might notice that on page 43, the Authorized Standard Version says, reins and heart. Reins and heart, you'll get that, instead of kidneys and heart. Reins and heart. But if you look in Webster, you will see reins means kidneys. But reins, I think, is very confusing. Kidneys is much easier. You know what kidney is, but reins, you're not used to the term. All right? Reins means kidneys as the first meaning. Unfortunately, the translators of the American Standard Version decided to interpret instead of translate. Now look at the confusion. Psalm 7, verse 9. Oh, let the wickedness of the wicked come to an end, but establish thou the righteousness. For the righteous God trieth the minds and hearts. Now in the Hebrew, that's not minds and hearts. That's hearts and kidneys. Hearts and kidneys. They decided they had to do something with kidneys, so they changed it around. They made minds hearts, and they made hearts kidneys. So that's really confused. Psalm 26. Examine me, O Jehovah, and prove me. Try my heart and my mind. For thy loving kindness is before mine eyes. I have walked in thy truth. I have not sat with men of falsehood. Well, here they switched it around again. It's heart and mind that they've got is really kidneys and heart. Here they've got mind for heart and heart for kidneys. Really confusing. Okay, go to the next one, Jeremiah. But Jehovah of hosts, that trieth the righteous, that seest the heart and the mind, let me see thy vengeance on them, for unto thee have I revealed my cause. Here it is again, kidneys and heart. And they've clouded it up. They fixed it so you can't find out what it means in the New Testament about he'll search the kidneys and the heart. And you can't find out because they've changed all the words. Unless you run this down, the kidneys excrete waste products. And the kidneys of the animal sacrifices were carefully examined for ritual cleanness. Now, I didn't put all that in. You can go back to Leviticus and see that. Now, this is its type. Remember, it's a figure. Remember, it's a Jewish figure. Remember, it goes to tabernacle. And all of this symbolism of this book is in the tabernacle. And if you're going to stay in some other place, you won't ever find the answer. You've got to find it back in the tabernacle and in the religious system they have. Only if the kidneys were clean could the blood of the sacrifice be sprinkled. And that's from the Talmud, Pesachim, page 411. Okay, Jeremiah 17 says, the heart is deceitful above all things and is exceedingly corrupt. Who can know it? I, Jehovah, search the mind, that's the word heart. I try the heart, that's the word kidneys. I examine the kidneys. See how they've messed it up? even to give every man according to his ways, according to the fruit of his doing. God then makes the judgment, and he searches the heart, because the heart's deceitful above things, and he examines the kidneys. Now, this is a type, then, of the elimination of the waste products, of that that's useless, disposed of. Have you gotten rid of the waste products in your life? He examines your heart and how it stands before God. He examines the kidneys as, have you gotten rid of the waste things in your life? It has, again, a symbolical significance entirely and does not occur elsewhere in the New Testament, but it comes from the examination of the animal sacrifices, a field in which we need to do a lot someday, but I don't know when we'll ever get there. Page 52. Revelation 2:26, the ones keeping my works until the finish. Finish of what? Matthew 24:6 says, and ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled, for these things must needs come to pass, but the, not end, the finish is not yet. Same word. Verse 13, but he that endureth to the end, not end, finish. It's the same word. You can't keep changing them around and never hope to find out where we're going. The same shall be saved, and this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world for a testimony to all nations, and then shall the end come. And then it says, the finish will be present. The finish will be present. Now, all right, now what we've got to do, and I can't help but do this, I have to make a little digression here. Because if you notice, the gospel of the kingdom shall be preached into the whole world for a testimony unto all nations, and then the finish will be present. Okay. Now, the gospel of the kingdom, and they have used this verse to the idea that they must get missionaries out all over the world to preach the gospel all over the world before the Lord comes, and they all have to hear the gospel. That isn't what he's talking about at all. Because back in the New Testament, we already read that the gospel was preached to the whole world. The gospel, the good news of salvation. That's been preached. That's not what he's talking about. He said the gospel of the kingdom. When was the gospel of the kingdom preached to the whole world? I think the gospel of the kingdom was preached to the whole world instantaneously. All the at the same time, when they took and went to the UN, and there on one of the flagpoles, they hoisted the flag of the state of Israel. And the kingdom was established and declared worldwide instantaneously to all nations. And I believe we entered the finish at that moment. And we're coming to the crescendo and the end of all of these things. It's present, and we're winding it up right now. The minute that flag went up, that was the gospel of the kingdom. It says in Psalm, thou hast given them thy banner that they be made displayed because of the truth. What is the truth? The kingdom is reassembled and the nation of Israel once again exists. And it's fact, not matter of fiction, not matter of question. You haven't any question about it. It's there. Are you going to tell me that flag doesn't fly at the UN? I've been there and seen it fly there. Are you going to tell me the flag of Jerusalem, King of Kings and Lord of Lords, with the lion on that flag and the two olive branches, doesn't fly over the city of Jerusalem? I've been there and seen rows of them lit up at night flying over the city of Jerusalem. And anybody else has seen them. And I don't know about you, but when you know the Lord Jesus Christ as your personal Savior and you go up that hill, I can't go up that hill and see Jerusalem with the lights on those flags flying around the city of the great King without tears down my face, without any shame or hesitancy at all. Because he's coming King of Kings and Lord of Lords, and that flag flies. He's the Lion of the tribe of Judah, and their Messiah will come on due course as he has said he will come. And these things are moving fast. And so there you have that verse. This is the finish, so we've got to keep that in mind. Because you see, back there in the verse where it said that, where does that word finish come up? Until the finish. That was back in verse 26. The one having victory and the one keeping my works until the finish. See, this church is the church of Thyatira, is going to the finish. It's going all the way. The other churches have dropped out of the picture. There isn't any more really Ephesus church, and there's really no more of the Smyrna church. We're past that particular period. And we're moving on in. The Pergamon church just sandwiched right in, dovetailed right into the Thyatira church. So that's more or less gone. Now we come to these church periods, and that's why it fascinates me so much more, because these church periods are clearing, going to continue right into the end time. Note again, the Thyatira church continues until Jesus is present, page 44, Revelation 2:25. The one having victory is to be given authority over the Gentiles, page 50. And he will shepherd them. Who? The Authorized Standard Version, as well as the King James, have translated the verb to shepherd by the verb to rule. Now watch all of this carefully. The King James translates five Greek words to verbs to rule. Further confusion is brought about in the King James by translating the noun poimen, shepherd, 17 times, and pastor, one time. And can you imagine that? Why insert one pastor? The word pastor doesn't occur in the Bible. That isn't in the Bible at all, the word pastor. It's shepherd. While the verb poimeno, and that's the verb to shepherd, is translated feed 7 times and 4 times rule. And it's the verb to shepherd. I think you can see that. Can't you see that those words are very much alike? That noun and the verb, put your finger on them, look at them. The first letter, those spelled in English letters, P-O-I-M, and then the endings are different. One's a noun, one's a verb. To shepherd. Now, next paragraph. To shepherd and to rule are certainly quite different. The victor is to shepherd them. Them is masculine plural, and Gentiles is neuter plural. A pronoun agrees with its antecedent in gender and number. Do we change the rule or look for another antecedent? Could the antecedent be others? That is, those that are back in verse 24, where none of his, I've got a note in brackets there, see Robertson's grammar, where none of his so-called exceptions are really exceptions at all. Let's stick with the rule. It's got to modify something in the same gender and number. The understanding of Revelation 2:27 depends on how carefully we can match the thoughts with the Old Testament statements. Let us adhere to the meaning of the Greek word to shepherd and find the proper antecedent to them according to the simple rule. All right, let's turn over to page 53. Why do the nations rage and the peoples meditate a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against Jehovah and against his anointed. Let us break their bonds asunder and cast away their cords from us. He that sitteth in the heavens will laugh. The Lord will have them in derision. Then will he speak unto them in his wrath and vex them in his sore displeasure. Yet I have set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. I will tell of the decree. Jehovah saith unto me, Thou art my son. This day have I begotten thee. Ask of me, and I will give thee the nations for thine inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. Thou shalt break them with a rod of iron. Thou shalt dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. Now therefore be wise, O ye kings. Be instructed, ye judges of the earth. Serve Jehovah with fear, and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry, and ye perish in the way, for his wrath will soon be kindled. Blessed are all they that take refuge in him. That this psalm, come back at the top, was in part fulfilled, we have from Acts chapter 4. That Psalm 2 refers to Jesus is clear. And I hate to stop, but we've got to stop there. Thank you.